Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hello and welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem, and it is, we're 16 days into June, right? Is it the 16th?
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, nodding your head, I suppose, really doesn't work on radio.
When, it's like the carpenter assistant, when I nod my head, hit it. Anyway, so, all right, so it is the 16th. It's the merry month of June, of course, and that's wedding month, and we're going to talk a little about marriage today.
Marriage. Marriage is what brings us together today. Marriage, that wedding arrangement, that dream within a dream.
You know, I can pretty much quote that whole movie, which is a whole, that's a whole nother story and probably a sad discussion. But
inconceivable.
I don't think that means what you think it means. I'm looking forward to spending some time today with Margaret Kim Peterson and husband Dwight Peterson. They have co-written a new book just out called Are You Waiting for the One? It's cultivating realistic, positive expectations for Christian marriage, and is out from InterVarsity Press. And I've had a chance to chat with Margaret in the past, and I highly recommend her writings, and just had an opportunity to say hello to Dwight here just a moment ago. We're looking forward to spending some time together. Margaret and Dwight, great to have you on the show.
So good to be with you.
Good to be with you.
This the book, talking about waiting for the one, as I understand, it's kind of came out of, I guess I could explain a little bit about your background, both serving and working at Eastern University, St. David's, PA. Margaret is associate professor of theology there, and Dwight's professor of New Testament. And this kind of what came out of your work with students? I mean, your theology professors, and was this just something that sort of happened on the side? Let's talk about marriage and relationships.
Well, it kind of did. You know, I teach theology and church history at Eastern, and Dwight teaches New Testament and Greek there, and usually when you teach theology or New Testament, you don't get a chance to teach a course on something really practical like marriage. But Eastern turned out to be kind of flexible and open, and we had this idea, and it fit into the curriculum. And so about 10 or 11 years ago, we started teaching a course that was just called Christian Marriage. And it just kind of took on a life of its own. We ended up with 60 or 70 students in the class, you know, once a year in the fall. We would teach it in the fall semester. And we just had all of these wonderful conversations with students and an opportunity to read their writing about things they were thinking about and have conversations in class. And it really didn't take very long before we realized, you know, there's a book here. To grow out of the conversations that we've had in class with all of these young people who really care about relationships and their futures as potentially as husbands and wives.
Lots of talk about marriage, not always sort of good discussion necessarily, and maybe confusion about it. But one thing I guess that's pretty clear is marriages are happening later and with less frequency. Let's talk about why is that, you think?
Well, it's just a longer process to get settled in adult life these days. You know, it's not really that people choose to have it take longer. It just does. You know, there's an expectation that people will go to college, and that takes a number of years, and then, you know, people want to get settled financially. People are a lot more mobile, too, now, and it used to be you pretty much spent most of your life, most people spent most of their life close to where they were born and grew up, and now there's an expectation that people will travel for education, you know, go someplace away to college and maybe then move another place for work. And it's simpler and more straightforward to do that as a single person. So marriage ends up kind of getting put on the back burner. The thought is you don't want to do that too soon, or it might get disrupted, you know, by the other changes in your life, and people don't want that.
Well, but that's sort of part of it, isn't it, that we look at the other things that we want to do in life as sort of a higher priority, right?
Well, I think that can happen, but you know, I think there's a lot of fear around marriage too, because you know, people see failed marriages, and you know, a failed marriage can be one that ended in divorce. A failed marriage can also be one that's really conflictual or unhappy or empty or even violent, and people don't want that, and so they think, you know, I ought to wait because this is so important. You know, it's not just that they're putting it on the back burner because it's less important. Sometimes it gets put on the back burner because it's seen as very, very important. And people aren't sure they have the tools to succeed, so they wait.
And Dwight, I want to give you an opportunity to jump in too. I mean, you know, I can talk with Margaret all day, but and which I, you probably can as well. But
I could talk to Margaret all day. Okay. That's the truth. We're sitting here at our dining room table, and I'm just watching her talk and enjoying it.
Okay. Well, you can add
I'll,
to the
I'll,
discussion.
I'll pour it in.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, I think, particularly as you set out in the book, you know, the idea of kind of the, well, I guess the subtitles, but a realistic positive expectation for Christian marriage suggests that maybe we don't have a realistic or necessarily positive expectation for Christian marriage today.
Well, I think that's true. I think that there are a lot of negative expectations for marriage out there. I don't think people mean it that way, but when we hear our students say that people are always telling them how much work marriage is, how hard it is, how hard you have to work at it, we wonder, you know, what do people think that marriage involves, really? And then as far as realistic expectations are concerned, I think sort of the other, you know, what you get at the other end of the pendulum swinging is people saying, well, it will be bliss, sheer bliss, and everything will be perfect, or everything ought to be perfect. So if you're in a marriage and everything isn't perfect, you think, oh, my gosh, there's something terribly wrong with me. And so one of the things that we've really, really tried to do in our class and with our students is, you know, be realistic about what it takes to build a relationship that's successful and fun, and, you know, what's realistic to hope for? You know, how do you, you know, what kinds of challenges ought you to expect? What kinds of tools should you expect you'll need to have in order to succeed?
We also talk about positive expectations. You know, lots of people, and certainly lots of our students, have grown up in homes that were less than ideal. And so part of what Margaret and I do when we teach our class and what we were thinking about when we were writing the book is to model, to the extent that we can, a good marriage in front of our students. And then by the end of the class, we end up saying, look, you can do this. It's possible to live well in the married state. You can, in fact, do it. So that's a big part of what we had in mind in the book, too, to imagine with our readers things that they can do and ways that they can be that can help them have a good marriage.
The book is called Are You Waiting for the One? Subtitled Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage, from Margaret Kim Peterson and Dwight N. Peterson, my guest today. Here's a question, I guess. Is love and romance an attainable goal or an expectation for marriage today?
Sure. Yeah, we think love and romance are wonderfully attainable goals. Yeah, we've done it ourselves. We kind of like it. We recommend it. But again, it sort of depends what you mean. I mean, people use romance sometimes to mean, you know, a fairy tale in which everything always goes right. And, you know, our experience of romance isn't that it's a fairy tale in which everything always goes right. You know, romance is part of a broader spectrum of experiences that you have in the context of marriage. And, you know, it's wonderful and it's fun and it's great to have it be there. And there are things that you can do to, you know, help foster that. And love is certainly a lot bigger than romance. And, you know, it exists in families. It exists with friends. One hopes it can exist between husband and wife. But, again, it's like the rest of life. It's always mixed. It's always sort of enjoyable in some places and more of a challenge in other places. So, again, the word realistic really is good for us. You know, I mean, we see realistic as not being kind of a downer, but as being an entry into the real stuff of real life.
Well, you do talk a little bit about, right at the outset, about how Christians are sort of succumbing to, I guess, the romanticized ideals of marriage, right? And that there's a lot of books and seminars and teaching out there that may not be helping us get a good sort of biblical framework for what marriage is all about.
That chapter originated in a public lecture that Margaret and I gave, gee whiz, about 10 years ago now, that we entitled God Doesn't Want to Write Your Love Story. And the idea behind it was not that God is not interested in your love life, but that there are ways of imagining what having God involved in your love life can look like that are less than positive, that often involve, for instance, turning your rationality off, not taking responsibility for your own decisions. And Margaret, help me here.
Well, I caught sort of three words that I thought like you'd expand on a little bit, because sort of in that context, you talk about what is sort of a typical maybe presentation. There's isolation and imagination, and then there's this revelation. And so talk about what you were setting up there.
Well, again, I think maybe one thing to say right now is the people who do this, they mean so well. They really do want to help people toward positive and healthy relationships, but this is not a good way to do it. And the message in a lot of these Christian romance books is that marriage is completely different from any other relationship. So if you really want to be married, you need to not have close emotional relationships with anybody else. And then you sort of imagine what your future mate is going to look like and what your life with that future mate is going to look like. And you cultivate this fantasy and you write it all down and you write letters to this imaginary soulmate that one of these days you're going to meet. And then while you're moving through the world, all of a sudden you meet somebody and you think, okay, this is the one. This is the person. I just know. I'm just sure that this is the person God has for me. And it's a very limited way to approach life and relationships. You know, the relationship, intimate relationship, fun relationship, meaningful relationship is way bigger than just romance or just that special someone. And the way to move, we think, toward having, you know, again, a range of rewarding relationships and, you know, maybe that special relationship with someone you might marry, is not to imagine what it might be in the future, but to build positive, content-filled relationships now. And then as far as choosing a partner, we think it's really a good idea to think about it, not just to feel about it, but really a good idea to think about it and to make a considered decision for or against a particular relationship leading to marriage.
Well, that's certainly something where us as parents, we want to be able to encourage our kids as well for them to think. And I guess all of us know that once we've sort of jumped in, that the rationality sometimes goes out the window. So maybe the more we can have those discussions ahead of time, the better off it will be. And we're having a discussion today about it, and we'll invite our listening family to join in the discussion as well. If you are maybe at that point where you're waiting for the one, or you're planning a wedding perhaps there this month, we'd love to hear your conversation, part of the conversation as well. You can join us at 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484. And we're talking today with Margaret Kim Peterson, Dwight Ann Peterson, co-authors of the book called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. We'll talk about what makes a marriage Christian in just a minute as we continue on with the conversation today on Connecting Faith.
Love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. This, I tell you, brother.
All right, we're talking marriage. We're giving a realistic and a positive approach to Christian marriage today. Are You Waiting for the One? It's the title of the book. Our discussion today with Margaret Kim Peterson and Dwight Ann Peterson. And we'd welcome your calls. Maybe there's some unrealistic expectations you had. Love to hear your story, or just have some questions about how to present those issues to family and friends. 877-93-FAITH. I've got a couple of copies of the book to give away, and be happy to do that, do a little drawing at the end of the hour. For those that check in and join the show, 877-933-2484. So, guys, let's talk about what makes a marriage Christian.
Well, one of the things that we try to stress with our students is that there's no kind of magical formula or checkoff sheet that if you do these three things, then you have a Christian marriage. That we see Christian marriage as being part of Christian life, and that the kinds of things that characterize a Christian life are, we hope, things that we'll bring into our marriages. One of the things that we've sometimes done is assign a book to our students on the Christian life, sort of understood in terms of the fruit of the Spirit. And we've occasionally had students write us essays where they say, you know, I saw we were going to read this book on the fruit of the Spirit, and I thought, well, what does that have to do with marriage? And then I read the book, and I thought, boy, I want all of these things in my marriage. So that's one of the ways we think about it. Dwight, do you want to say something? He's motioning to me to continue. This is kind of one of the dynamics that happens in our class. I look to him, and he says, keep talking.
Keep going.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So I'll keep talking. You know, another thing we talk about in the book is how the Christian liturgies for marriage are one of the things that kind of communicate expectations over generations for what marriage is going to be. Things like marriage as a context for the bearing and rearing of children, marriage as a place for sex to be good and life-enhancing and you know, as God intends it to be, marriage is a place for spouses to support one another and to bear with one another faithfully in everything that life brings, you know, until death do us part. You know, those are all things that make a marriage Christian.
I was interested, maybe kind of a side note, but as I was reading a little bit of, talking about some of the liturgy and the history, that I thought it was interesting that the latest royal wedding, that there was a fair amount of traditional review of the long-standing ideals about marriage.
Now, I have to say, I only saw a very little bit of the royal wedding. I was getting my car fixed that morning, and it was on the television at the repair shop. But it is the case that one of the things that Christian marriage liturgies do is they gather together lots of people in support of this couple, and then the liturgy rehearses, well, what is marriage? What is marriage for? It's a chance for everybody who's been married to think, well, now what did I promise? And for people who aren't married to think, will I ever want to do this? Or, you know, if I do enter into the married state, what's that going to look like for me? And then it creates a context, a community for the new married couple to have some support and some guidance and some company on the way. And I do think that that's one of the things that can get lost in our culture today, that we tend to think of marriage in more individualistic terms. And, you know, people write their own vows and, you know, they want to have a wedding that reflects who they are in a really personal or idiosyncratic way. And, you know, of course, there's a place for you know, personalizing things. But we wonder if sometimes people aren't trying to reinvent the wheel and that maybe the reason, you know, we end up with some kinds of challenges in marriage is because we're not open to learning as much as we might from others and from people who've gone before.
You're talking about sort of the individualistic perspective. I know you address issues like kind of the career track or not, you know, I guess we sort of touched on about, you know, waiting because I don't want anything sort of get in the way of my plans. But you know, lots of kind of confusion today about, you know, sex and children and all those things. Let's talk a little bit about that, how maybe the world's influence have really infected us as believers as well.
Well, I think that's true. You know, one of the things we talk about in the book is how even among Christians there is an expectation that young people not get too tied down too soon because, you know, life is full of choices and it's full of options. And the way you have a really full life is you're able to make a lot of choices and have a lot of options open to you. And so while I think there are many Christian parents who would be very happy to have their children married relatively young, you know, in their early 20s, say, as opposed to in their later 20s, a lot of those same parents do not think it would be a good idea for their kids in their early 20s, even if they're married, to be having children yet, because they think, well, that will tie you down. I mean, how will you manage to go to graduate school? How will you manage to build your career? How will you, you know, do all of those things that young people ought to be able to do, you know, travel and be kind of, you know, without constraint? And so we end up having, you know, a pregnancy in a couple who've only been married a year or two be an emergency because, oh my gosh, there were all these things that we were supposed to do before we had children. Now we won't be able to do them. And that seems to us to be, I don't know, just not really in accord with the really positive and hospitable vision that Christian tradition has had for children in marriage. You know, children are a blessing. They're one of the things marriage is for.
Well, so let's talk about one of your chapters called Why Christians Have Children. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, well, we do talk about that in the book. And, you know, our sense is that one of the big reasons Christians have children is, again, it's a special version of hospitality. It's a way of having this very intimate relationship, the marriage relationship, be not just for the husband and wife alone, but open to those whom God gives to them as their children. And, you know, this is something we think doesn't get remembered often enough or doesn't get said openly enough, that children end up being kind of a lifestyle choice. And, you know, in the world we live in where there's contraception available and, you know, good reasons to use it under a whole range of circumstances, it does kind of alter the moral calculus of childbearing and child rearing. You know, children end up being seen not as sort of the fruit of the marriage relationship or as you know, gifts that God gives as God wills to give them, but as choices that we make and choices we ought to make. And, you know, we shouldn't make irresponsible choices about when to have kids or whether to have kids.
And, you know, we do talk about child rearing in terms of hospitality. And hospitality, of course, means something like welcoming strangers. And anybody who's had a child knows that children are strangers. You know, our son, whom we adopted when he was just 10 days old, you know, when he was really small, he did what little small children do, not much. And then as he started to grow up, he became sort of his own idiosyncratic person who's very different from Margaret and very different from me. And part of the challenge of being a parent, right, is to make room for this strange little guy who's in your family. And I think it can be sort of seen as practice for making room for other strange little people, other interesting foreign to you kinds of people who you can welcome into your lives in the name of Christ.
Well, in fact, even just that phrase probably is one of the key aspects of understanding what marriage is all about, right? Making room. I mean, it's making room for another in a relationship and for different viewpoints and conflict and all those kinds of things, right?
Well, that's the truth, isn't it? We talk about children being strange little people. Well, spouses are strange to you too, aren't they? You know, you think you know them, and then you don't. You know, there are constantly areas of your spouse's life. I guess I'm speaking from my own experience, and maybe some from Margaret's, that we sort of turn a corner and realize something new about each other. And part of being married well is sort of habitually being able to make room for that.
We're talking today with Dwight Peterson and Margaret Kim Peterson, the husband and wife team, have co-written a book called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage, published by University Press. Both Dwight and Margaret teach at Eastern University at St. David's, Pennsylvania. Margaret's written several other books, including,
Keeping House.
Yeah, that's highly recommended. Great book. Also, Sing Me to Heaven and others. We'd welcome your part of the conversation as well. We're talking a little bit about preparing for marriage and preparing for life and relationships. And you can join us at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2444. I'm curious, guys, talk a little bit about history. We've got a couple of minutes here before the break, but just what you discovered about, how marriages and weddings have developed over the centuries.
Well, I think one of the biggest changes in marriage over the centuries is that marriage, the choice of a marriage partner really didn't used to be left up to the people involved. The parties getting married to each other were not primarily responsible for the choice. Their parents were responsible for it because marriage was seen as something that was about families and the union of two families. And in more recent days, in our own day, we really don't tend to think about marriage in those terms, and which is odd in the sense that a marriage affects families in all sorts of, huge and thoroughgoing ways. But we leave the choice of a marriage partner now, typically, again, in this culture, up to the people who are getting married. And that is a real shifting of perspective on what marriage is about from the more communal to the more individual. So that's one big change that has happened over time. Also, I think our sense of what marriage is for has really shifted. Marriage used to be very much oriented toward just survival in the world, and gender roles were very specifically delineated. Women had certain kinds of things they contributed. Men had things that they contributed. And to keep a household running, you really need to have one of each. You needed to have a married couple to be at the head of that household. And things have changed a lot now. There's a lot more flexibility in terms of what men and women can choose to do with their lives and how they can contribute in the world and whether they can get along without a partner or not. And so marriage has become less practical in its focus and more sort of personal and relational. You want somebody who you get along with, who you enjoy, who's fun to be with, who kind of, it is, again, kind of psychologically or emotionally rewarding, and there's less thought about the practicalities, which, again, is kind of crazy because marriage really is a very, very practical arrangement. There that person is every single day, and you've got to figure out how to make it work.
Another thing that we talk about toward the end of the book is the increasing expense of marriages or of weddings. It seems today that one of the areas that you can spend almost without limit and not feel guilty about it is on your wedding. And so young people and their families can go into almost incredible debt, right, to just have a really big party. And we think a party associated with a wedding is a good idea. We had turns out a small party with respect to, or when we were married, but we love parties in conjunction with marriages. But there is a tendency to overspend, and it can be unhelpful to the newly married couple to emerge from a wedding already in debt.
We're going to talk some more and take your calls at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. We've got a couple of copies of Margaret Kim Peterson's and Dwight Peterson's book, Are You Waiting for the One? It's a great resource, something I might help pass on to family or friends, or even just add to your church library. Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. It's our topic today. And Margaret, Kim, and Dwight will return here in just a couple of minutes. We want to talk a little bit about building a deep relationship, what that looks like, and how to grow old and in love, all those things. Coming up here in a couple of minutes on Connecting Faith. Past the hour, it's Connecting Faith, and today we're connecting with Margaret Kim Peterson, her husband Dwight Peterson. They've co-written a new book called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage from InterVarsity Press. Both Margaret and Dwight teach at Eastern University of St. David's, PA, in theology, New Testament theology, and Margaret's written Keeping House, also Sing Me to Heaven, and they've together done lectures on God Doesn't Want to Write Your Love Story, and part of that is sort of a preview to our discussion today. And understanding, I guess, you know, if God doesn't want to write our love story, guys, what do we make some recommendations for encouraging our teen and adult children as they pursue a relationship? You know, some of the things that they ought to be looking for in terms of building, you know, deep relationships. And you know, if there's some biblical foundation, too, as well, as we go along, I'd love to hear it.
Well, one of the things that we talk with our students about is how I think there are, I don't know, we've never met a Christian who didn't care about building deep relationships or who didn't want to have, you know, a strong, you know, supportive network of intimate relationships as an adult, whether or not that included marriage. But sometimes we express our desires in ways that turn out to be cliches that don't have a lot of content. And so, you know, I want God to write my love story is one way to talk about it, or to say, I want to keep God at the center of my relationship. That's another way to say it. And, you know, we say to our students, well, what does that mean? And they say, well, I don't know. and so then we try to say, well, now let's think. What would it mean to have a Christian relationship? And, again, one of the things that we think that it means is being kind, yeah, in a really reliable kind of way, being gentle, being willing to be honest about what you're thinking and feeling and make there be room for the other person to be honest about what they're thinking and feeling.
Being able to listen to the other one, I mean really listen. Sometimes we imagine that listening is a very passive activity. It turns out that if you listen well, it's hard work. You know, you have to attend to the person that's talking to you. You have to try to really understand what they're saying, and sometimes you have to ask follow-up questions so that you can make sure that you're actually hearing what the other person is saying. This can be this is not a natural gift that most of us are born with. It's something that needs to be cultivated, and cultivating it can really make a big difference in a marriage.
I think just doing things together too. You know, I mean, we talk a lot about talking. I mean, I think sometimes that can be,
yeah.
I don't know, sort of, you know, I hate to put it this way, but too feminine an emphasis. You know, what do girlfriends do when they get together? Well, they talk. Well, what do guys do? Well, they do stuff. And, you know, doing stuff is important too for the girls as well as for the guys. You know, working at things together, having there be a project. I think, again, there are so many options for kind of entertainment and busyness in our culture that we think that we've spent time with somebody when we've done something entertaining with them or when we've been busy together. But to really work together on a project, or, you know, alternatively, to take time to really have a long, in-depth, interesting conversation about something, these are things that really build relationships. And I guess another thing I would say, oh, you see, I'm jumping in.
No, go ahead.
Things before, not giving you time to talk.
Go ahead.
What was I going to say?
Okay.
Gosh, now I've forgotten. okay, time for you to talk.
Well,
sure, I thought we'll come back to
that. I have something that I can just horn in on here.
Sure.
One of the things that we have come to see in our teaching of the marriage class and our writing of this book is how important sort of habits of communication are between people. How a lot of times, and especially maybe with young people, but maybe not so especially, there can be a tendency to be sharp, not really friendly, overly sarcastic with people, really critical of, especially sometimes, of people that you like the most. And what Margaret and I try to do with each other and try to teach our students to do and say a little bit in the book about doing is to be careful about the words that come out of your mouth, to be kind with what you say. We have a story that is recounted in the book of a woman that took our class about 10 years ago. She was older than most students. She was probably 40-ish. And she and a girlfriend that she had in her neighborhood were walking one day and decided that for a week, each of them would try to say kind things to their husbands, like things like, thank you, and I appreciate you so much. Oh, that was good of you to do that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. That kind of lacing their conversation with kind words. And they came back a week later, and they were amazed at what a difference it made. Go ahead, Margaret.
And I think sometimes we think that for things to change for the better in a relationship, something really big and dramatic has to happen. But I think sometimes what the relationship needs is just kind of, I don't know, lubrication with the oil of kindness. Just being nice in an intentional kind of way and spending time, you know, giving the relationship time and attention, not necessarily lots and lots of it. I mean, we've all got lots of commitments that we have to keep, but having the relationship be as important as some other things and giving it attention, giving it nurturance.
You know, on the other side of that, I guess the other side of the spectrum is conflict, and you spend a whole chapter talking about that, of conflict and even violence and safety. You know, obviously, sadly, this is something that we need to be addressing before marriage and certainly into marriage as well.
Well, this has become a really key focus of our class, is talking about conflict and, sadly, again, about violence. And the reason that happened was before we taught the class for the first time, we were talking about the idea with two faculty-colleague couples. And as we were chatting with these four people, these two couples, it turned out that three of the four of them had grown up in violent homes. And we were just shocked because neither of us did. You know, we sort of knew that that kind of thing happened, but, you know, we hadn't really thought about it happening to people we knew. And so we thought, my gosh, we need to open the door to conversation about this, you know, when we teach our class. And we didn't really know what to say, but we brought up the subject. And my gosh, the stories we got from our students. And it's just, it's been a lesson in how hard this is for so many families and married couples to negotiate. And now, unfortunately, in a lot of dating relationships, violence is becoming more of an issue. And so we talk about that a lot in the book, and we talk about it a lot in class. And I guess one of the number one things we say is conflict and violence are not the same. You know, every relationship is going to have conflict because people aren't identical and they have different ideas and different preferences. Violence is an attempt to use control, coercion, violence itself as a way to control the other person. And you don't have to go there, and you don't need to go there, and there are ways to navigate conflict that aren't violent. And so, again, we've talked a lot with our students about, conflict resolution strategies and conflict addressing strategies that can help people build positive habits so that they don't then end up opening the doors that lead down the road to violence.
You talk about, mentioned how hard this is to do, and really, you know, kind of everything we talked about. I mean, it's something that is probably new and foreign to us, for many, at least as we think back to our pursuit of marriage and that whole process. So I guess maybe the question is, what do we do? Are there some, before our time gets away, are there some practical tips or some steps, or maybe, you know, are there biblical principles is it simply just applying the fruit of the Spirit and these things are going to come? Or?
You know, we think there's more to it than applying the fruit of the Spirit and these things are going to come.
Although applying the fruit of the Spirit can't but be helpful, right?
Right.
Yeah, that always helps.
Yes.
But we think that there are sort of strategies that you can think of for addressing conflict in terms of trying to be honest with one another about what the conflict is about. You know, what are we arguing about? And, you know, what are the issues and why does this seem to matter so much? We think that thinking about families and the histories of conflict and conflict resolution in our families is really important.
There's a thing called a family map that we just stumbled upon before the first time we taught the class, and we did assign it the first time, didn't we, sweetie?
I think we did, yeah.
And what it is it's like a genealogy, except for you highlight the relationships and other things that you think are important about your family. So, for instance, if there's somebody who is the person who knows everything in your family, who knows all the history, you would highlight that. If there's a person in the family who seems to be sort of the hub of all conflict in the family, you would highlight that. What other kinds of things would we highlight in a family map suite?
Oh, just all kinds of patterns. You know, who got married and when they got married, and things like illness and health, and you know, I mean, just all sorts of ways to do it. But certainly, in terms of you know, bringing this back to the topic of conflict,
yes.
you can learn a lot about how you kind of the assumptions that you make about how conflict is going to happen and how it's going to be addressed by looking at the ways that it's happened in your own family, and then that gives you the freedom to make some different decisions for yourself
yeah.
if you need to.
I guess I was thinking in terms of even broader than just conflict. That I mean, you know, this is new territory for us. I mean, I guess unless we've been married one or two times before, and even then, obviously we want to make sure that we're doing things right. So just the whole kind of process, I think, is you know we don't necessarily have the realistic expectations, and so I guess we're looking for the strategies there as well, the bigger principles to hang on to.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, one of the things that you know, we've talked a lot about, I don't know whether we have time to really get into this before the break, but we've talked about Ephesians 5 with our students a lot because that talks about headship and submission in marriage. And a lot of Christians, we've found, think that what that discussion of headship and submission is all about is about conflict resolution and, in fact, about having there not be conflict in marriages. And we think that ends up being pretty counterproductive in a lot of cases, that it's that if you take that verse as meaning that somebody just gets to make the decision, quote unquote, and it's you know usually the husband who's identified as the one who makes the decision, then somehow your conflict will go away. Well, that just having somebody make a decision doesn't make a conflict go away. It just kind of drives it underground. And so we talk a lot about what it might look like to bring these conflicts up to the surface and have honest conversation about them, think about what some ways to address it might be, thinking about ways to come to consensus. We think compromise is highly overrated. You know, you get some, I get some, and then we're okay. Well, it turns into this tug of war that doesn't really resolve conflicts. It just makes everybody on the alert to make sure I don't lose this time. But you know, what does it look like to come to consensus, to find a way to agree on something that works for both of us? It's so much better to do that. It's a lot more work, but it's so much more rewarding, and ends up making husbands and wives or relationship partners feel you know jointly invested in the relationship and like they're both contributing something and they're both you know making something that's bigger than the sum of its parts. That's really and it's fun. It's exhilarating. It can be a very very positive and relationship building experience to do that.
All right. In a minute, we're going to give Margaret and Dwight an opportunity to give some marriage advice. We'll get to our phone calls here coming up. 877-93-FAITH is the phone number. You're welcome to join us as well. 877-933-2484. Got a couple of copies of the book. We'd be happy to give away. We'll do a little drawing at the end of the hour. Want to join the conversation? We have a question or maybe a story about some unrealistic expectations you had. We'd love to hear you in the conversation. 877-93-FAITH is the number. We're talking to Margaret Kim Peterson and Dwight Ann Peterson. The book's called Are You Waiting for the One? And we'll continue in a minute.
Love me tender, love me sweet, never
okay.
Let me go.
You know, what if the one could be more than one person? What if perfect love isn't all it's cracked up to be? What if we start thinking more about real love than perfect love? Some of the questions we're addressing today with Margaret Kim Peterson and Dwight Peterson. They co-written the book called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic, Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. And I want to check in with Tim, who's listening on Faith 1190 in Madison, seeking some advice on marriage. Tim, you're on with Margaret and Dwight. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm 47 years old. I've been in three failed relationships. One of them was a marriage. In the last 6 months, I've rededicated my life to Christ, dedicated it to Christ, and I'm looking for somebody to spend the rest of my life with, but I've got so much negative baggage, and I find myself overanalyzing almost everybody I meet, and I don't know what direction to go.
Good
question. I'm sure you're not alone, Tim. Guys, what do you think?
Well, I think the fact that you're raising the question about what your negative baggage looks like is just it's absolutely the right thing to do, to think about, you know, what's your story, and to really work on figuring out, well, you know, what happened in these relationships, and what was positive about them, what was negative about them, what did you contribute that was good, what did you contribute that you would do differently the next time. You know, getting to know that story is important, I think, and cultivating relationships with people you can talk with about this. And it might not at the beginning be somebody who you think might be that relationship partner, that person you want to spend the rest of your life with. It might be just friends. It might be a good counselor. It might be a pastor. It might be all of those things. People in your family. You know, think of people in your family who are people you feel like you can talk to, that you want to know better, and talk to them about your story and listen to their story. I think that those are really important pieces for any of us at any age as we're thinking about entering into relationships, is thinking about our stories and bringing those into conversation with other people and kind of getting the relational wheels turning in that way, rather than just thinking about what we want and don't have or the mistakes we've made. I mean, we've all made mistakes.
Yeah.
And bringing those things into conversation with others can be a really positive first step. Wait, do you have something you want to say?
No, I have myself been in the aftermath of broken relationships and a broken marriage myself, and I know, you know, how disheartening it can be afterwards. And for me, a big part of the healing process was finding a competent counselor to talk through my own responsibilities in my divorce. It was just really difficult and hard to face, but ultimately it was really helpful for me to begin, at least, to come to terms with my own culpability.
You know, got through the book, you do emphasize a lot about pursuing deep relationships, and it does seem like we have kind of assume that we can't pursue deep relationships except for that one, you know, and that we miss out on really God's design for us to really be a part of the body of Christ.
I think sometimes there's a tendency to think that intimacy means sexual intimacy, and then as Christians to think, well, that's only appropriate in marriage. So a truly intimate relationship is a marital relationship by definition. But I think intimacy is a lot broader and deeper and more complicated than just the sexual intimacy that is appropriate only in marriage. And that seeking for relationships that involve, you know, a real sharing of the self and a real sharing of stories and an exploration of who you are and who the other person is and who, you know, who you might be together as you talk with one another, this is something that it's really, really good and really life-giving to pursue with a whole range of people. You know, people who are members of your family, whether your immediate family or your extended family, and then people who are friends and people who are kind of maybe your peers in certain ways, your age peers or you know, you have similar interests, and then people who are very, very different from yourself. That there are lots and lots of different intimacies out there. And I think that the more we fill up our relationship cup with connections with lots of different people in different directions, the more we have a chance then of being the kind of person who maybe could meet that special someone and maybe could build that intimate relationship that is marriage in particular.
So as we're willing to go deeper and sort of sharing ourselves in relationships in general, that then out of that we can, you know, a special relationship can grow then perhaps.
Absolutely.
So how do we grow old and in love? You talk about that. You know, that this is a lifetime spectrum. Talk about that those later years.
Well, one of the things we talk about in the book is how things change with time, and it can feel like a change to a relationship is a threat to the relationship. That if it's a good relationship, we think, well, I never want this to change. You know, I never want to lose anything that's part of the relationship as it is now. But, you know, with time, everything changes, and change doesn't have to be negative. It doesn't have to be just loss. It can be a change from the goodness of youth to the goodness of maturity. And so just having that as an expectation and a hope and an openness, you know, what might it look like for us to grow older? What might it look like for us to have had more experiences together and to have faced disappointments, to have enjoyed successes, to have navigated transitions, just an openness to all the different kinds of change that marriage can bring. And, you know, cultivating the kind of partnership that doesn't kind of rigidly insist that everything stay the same, but that's flexible and open and says, well, gosh, we didn't expect this to happen, but we can do it together. I think that's a big key to growing old together.
We always have to deal with expectations, don't we? Because that's always, you know, we have incorrect ones, or we have unreasonable ones, or, I mean, whether it's house, home, or hospitality, whatever it might be.
Well, we do. And sometimes our expectations are tied to the sorts of homes we grew up in. We think, well, you know, my marriage will be pretty much like my parents' marriage was, or, you know, my life will be like my parents' lives were. And sometimes we have expectations that the culture suggests for us. We think that some of the sort of unhelpful expectations about romance and perfection kind of can come in that way. But there are expectations that can be really good and really positive. You know, we talk about expecting change as a good thing. We talk about expecting that your spouse isn't going to be everything to you. You know, that you're going to need friends. You're going to need support. You're going to need, you know, peers and, you know, wise older people in your life. Those can be really, really helpful expectations, because they can lead to there being more connections between you and your spouse and your home and family and other people, whether in the church or elsewhere.
You know, I know, Dwight, you're teaching New Testament, Margaret, do theology and history. I'm wondering if you can offer us some theological perspective. We've talked, obviously, a lot about sort of practical application of theology, but provide some sort of framework for us, and maybe if there's some passages that we have to revisit or can encourage, or maybe just to study with our adult children as they're pursuing mates, those kinds of things.
Dwight, do you want to say something, or you want me to talk?
You talk, and I'll horn in.
All right. Well, one of the things we talk about in the book is the way marriage is used in Scripture as a metaphor for God's relationship with his people. And so we wouldn't really so much point at a particular verse as we'd point to the whole story of Scripture, which is of faithfulness. And, you know, God loving his people, being faithful to them, being grieved by their faithlessness when that happens, but still being faithful, still loving, still caring. And just the fact that Scripture is a story that unfolds over time with all sorts of things happening, some of them expected and some of them unexpected. You know, those two things, I think, are really significant theological points to be made about marriage. It's about faithfully bearing with your partner and waiting and watching for the story to unfold and looking for all the points at which your little story connects with the big story of God and the world and Jesus and the church.
There are lots of pretty dark turns in the story between God and God's people. And one of the really wonderful things about reading Scripture from beginning to end is that you see that there is almost always room for redemption, room to make things better. To use the language of Deuteronomy, to repent and turn back to God. There are, I think, well, a lot of times I imagine that we can get into situations where we wonder if the sun will ever come out again. And a big part of the Christian or the biblical narrative is the sun will come out again, that it's possible to come back out into the sunshine after the darkness.
You know, we do live in a culture that, again, as we even touched on at the beginning, doesn't particularly highly regard marriage, and oftentimes Christians don't necessarily have better track records than anyone else. So what's your hope that maybe through this book and your continued teaching on this that we'll see take place?
Well, we would just love to see the readers of this book be encouraged and empowered, that I think one of the experiences I've had in my own life is the experience of receiving lots of help at times when I really needed it. And it's amazing how much more you can do when you've got help than when you don't. And I mean, it sounds silly, but it's so true. And we would love for this book to be helpful, to be something that helps the young people or the older people who read it to think, gosh, I can take this to my relationship, to my family, and make some good choices and open some good conversations and make some good decisions and be encouraged and do well, because it makes so much of a difference. It makes a difference in our own lives. It makes a difference in our children's lives or our family's lives. So we would love for the book to be helpful, to be a helpful tool that moves people farther along in the path of faithfulness.
Well, the professors have given us some helpful tools today. And by the way, we'll post the interview up on our on the website, on the Connecting Faith page at faithradionet.com. Faithradionet.com. You go to Connecting Faith and you'll have an opportunity to hear the podcast and share it with a friend. It'll be some great resource. And the book, a great resource as well. Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. It's new from Margaret Kim Peterson, Dwight Peterson, published by University Press. Margaret and Dwight, great to visit with you again. Thanks so much for taking a moment with us today.